Hello, I'm Mike Eastland. Welcome to Cross Currents, a weekly reading of local editorials and opinion pieces. As a reminder, all the views expressed are those of the writers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Chris Radio or its staff. Now let's turn first to the editorial and opinion pages of the Hartford Courant from the April 23rd edition. Our lead opinion today: approach toward childhood vaccinations should be reevaluated. This as written by Peyton Teske. In an era where scientific advancements have transformed healthcare and eradicated once deadly diseases, the resurfacing of vaccine-preventable illnesses raises alarming questions about public health. As we witness statewide outbreaks in cases of the once eradicated measles, we must reevaluate our approach toward childhood vaccinations. According to the World Health Organization, childhood vaccines continue to be the most effective public health intervention in human history, saving between 3.5 million to 5 million lives each year. Vaccines, through their ability to stimulate the immune system, have prevented the spread of infectious diseases. Despite the proven structure of vaccines, a growing number of parents are choosing not to vaccinate their children. Measles, a highly contagious and potentially deadly viral infection, serves as an upsetting reminder of the consequences of vaccine hesitancy. Declared eliminated from the United States in the year 2000, measles has made a comeback in recent years. The reasons include skepticism about vaccine safety, the spread of misinformation via social media, and the blissful dissociative reality of forgetting how contagious and deadly measles is to human beings. Mandating childhood vaccines is not a novel concept. In fact, the United States already requires vaccinations including polio, mumps, rubella, and diphtheria as a prerequisite for school entry. Exemptions for religious or philosophical reasons in some states have created pockets of vulnerability. The economic and educational burden of preventable diseases caused by outbreaks, as we have all learned firsthand, is overwhelming. Our already damaged education system saw even harsher setbacks from COVID-19, and those problems will become exponentially worse should vaccines be withheld from children. Disease outbreaks disrupt school routines, leading to missed days and causing educational and developmental delays. With vaccine mandates, we can create a more stable learning environment, promote academic success, and ensure that our future leaders can succeed. Critics argue that mandating vaccines dismisses personal autonomy and parental rights. The reality is that there is a price for freedom, and public health must take priority. The government already places restrictions on individual freedoms, like seatbelt laws or the cessation of smoking in public places. Similarly, a parent has the freedom to homeschool their child should they choose not to vaccinate their child. Mandating childhood vaccines is a necessary step towards safeguarding the well-being of our communities. The term herd immunity has become a household phrase due in part to the COVID-19 pandemic. It emphasizes the importance of maintaining high vaccination rates to protect those who cannot be vaccinated. By ensuring widespread immunity, we create a shield that prevents the spread of infectious diseases and protects the most vulnerable members of our society. To address these lapses in immunity, we need to address the root cause of vaccine hesitancy. Misinformation, propagated through various channels, has played a significant role in causing public mistrust in vaccines. Comprehensive, evidence-based, and collaborative public health campaigns, education, and transparent communication from healthcare professionals are essential to counteract myths and provide accurate information about vaccine safety and efficacy. Mandating vaccines should also be accompanied by efforts to improve access to vaccination services. Lack of healthcare access can contribute to lower vaccination rates in underserved communities. In Connecticut, Chapter 169, Section 10-204A, notes that any parent or guardian unable to provide a required vaccination due to cost will be paid for by the town. By addressing these disparities, we can ensure that all children, regardless of their socioeconomic background, have equal access to better health outcomes. In conclusion, the reappearance of measles and the trend toward vaccine hesitancy demands a motivated response. Mandating childhood vaccines is not only a practical solution to protect the health of our children, but also an investment in the well-being, productivity, and stability of our society. It is time to prioritize the health of our communities and safeguard our future through the power of mandatory childhood vaccines. Is it time to amend Chapter 169, Section 10-204A, and mandate childhood vaccines? What you can do to make a statement on this public health matter. If you are a parent looking for a Connecticut vaccine provider, please call 860-509-7929. If you feel motivated about mandating vaccines, join the Connecticut Immunization Coalition, which is dedicated to promoting vaccinations throughout the community. As always, you can contact your local health representatives or the State Department of Public Health to express your concerns. The author, Peyton Teske, is a lifelong Connecticut native and has been a registered nurse since 2020. She is currently in the AGA-CNP program at UConn. Another opinion piece, this one from the April 21st edition of the Hartford Current, as written by John Nogowski, entitled, Lincoln Saw a Future That Threatened All That Had Come Before Lincoln Memorial. You could just hear his tinny but sincere voice. The operation of this mobocratic spirit, which all must admit is now abroad in the land, any government, and particularly of those constituted like ours, may effectually be broken down and destroyed whenever the vicious portion of population shall be permitted to gather in bands of hundreds and thousands and burn churches, ravage and rob provision stores, throw printing presses into rivers, shoot editors, and hang and burn obnoxious persons at pleasure and with impunity. Depend on it, this government cannot last. When 28-year-old Illinois State Representative Abraham Lincoln felt the need to issue this stern warning one January night at the Springfield Lyceum 186 years ago, was he anticipating MAGA, January 6th, the end of everything? Sounds like it. And this was Illinois, not a state where you'd think slavery was a hot-button issue, not in 1838. The tall, clean-shaven Lincoln was then some 23 years and 3 months away from delivering his inaugural address on the steps of the Capitol in March of 1861, a surprising choice as our 16th president. A bare month after his inauguration, a Confederate attack on Fort Sumter initiated the Civil War. Did Abe feel all that coming on? Lincoln was responding to the tribal fever he felt all around him in what was suddenly a hot-blooded Illinois. A few months earlier, a pro-slavery mob had murdered journalist Elijah Lovejoy, an abolitionist. Nobody at the time said anything about fine people being on either side. Yet the war, which wouldn't start for many years and was several states away, somehow seemed to be in the Illinois air. Lincoln wanted to remind everybody what we had already, a democracy, was worth keeping. He offered a simple solution. Let every American, every lover of liberty, every well-wisher to his prosperity, swear by the blood of the Revolution never to violate in the least particular the laws of the country and never to tolerate their violation by others. How would honest Abe react to news of the plan of the alternate electors, the insurrection, the big lie, the president himself holding Lincoln's former owner office, calling the Secretary of State of Georgia asking for enough votes to swing an election? I think we have a pretty good idea. Many years before Lincoln would assume the office of the presidency, he was speaking to the Springfield Lyceum as a two-time state representative, already thinking big and asking his audience to do the same. As the Patriots of 76 did to support of the Declaration of Independence, so to the support of the Constitution and laws, he said that evening, let every American pledge his life, his property, and his sacred honor. Let every man remember that to violate the law is to trample on the blood of his father and to tear the character of his own and his children's liberty. To trample on the blood of his father, to tear the character of his own and his children's liberty. Remember, he wasn't reading from a teleprompter. He wasn't campaigning, trying to win votes. giving a speech for the newspapers. He was taking a stand because it was the right time to do so, even if nobody particularly asked him to. At the time, Lincoln was a scrawny, little-known, two-time state representative from Illinois, years before the great conflict, almost physically sensing what lay ahead for his country. Almost certainly never thinking on that January night, in a few swift years, he would be the one to try to stitch that badly torn fabric back together. In short, the young Lincoln continued that evening, let it become the political religion of the nation, and let the old and the young, the rich and the poor, the grave and the gay, of all sexes and tongues and colors and conditions, sacrifice and unceasingly upon its altars. Let's read that again. Of all sexes and tongues and colors and conditions, he said. This was in 1838. Most of us know about, maybe even memorized, his 272-word Gettysburg Address. Not as many study his brilliant 703-word second inaugural address, With Malice Towards None and Charity for All, where Lincoln, on the verge of winning the Civil War, found a way to cast the Great War as a scourge that came from above, so that every drop of blood drawn with the lash or slavery shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, the war. One historian calls it the least triumph speech ever delivered by a conqueror. Lincoln's Lyceum speech, thank goodness someone wrote it down, came some 27 years before the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of the Great War. It came on a chilly January evening, following the mob murder of an Illinois journalist who happened to be an abolitionist. He wasn't worried about his base. He wasn't worried about the polls. Lincoln might have been a long way from the White House that evening, but he saw a future that threatened all that had come before. He's still right. Changing papers now to the Waterbury Republican-American and their April 24th editorial entitled Book Ban, Clichés versus Reality. About 2 months ago, we published an editorial offering advice to the Goshen Library Board as it grappled with the public response to a controversial book, Gender Queer. The board settled on a solution similar to the one that we advocated: keep the book on the library shelves but limit access to adults. The book is tucked away on a top shelf in the upstairs adult fiction section, according to an April 22nd Republican-American report. Yet the controversy persists. Defenders of making the book, and presumably others like it, available to all and sundry, resorted to at least two popular but irrelevant clichés. Removing this book from the library collection would be antithetical to the core ethics surrounding librarianship, as well as unconstitutional. On the contrary, this is a question of curation, not constitutionality. The Constitution enjoins Congress from abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, but does not compel any entity, including a public library, to make available to its patrons anything and everything the First Amendment allows to exist. Critics of the removal of the book from the shelves last summer called it censorship, the April 22nd Republican-American story noted. Even the American Library Association, which routinely highlights LGBTQ-promoting books on its annual banned book list, acknowledges that obscenity and child pornography fall into the unprotected speech category. Gender Queer delivers obscenity via graphic illustrations and does not belong on a list containing the likes of Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye or Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Gender Queer and other books like it are available via Amazon for less than $20. They are neither banned nor censored, and public libraries like Goshen's are under absolutely no obligation to put them on shelves accessible to children, especially without parental consent being part of the process. In an April 21st editorial in the Waterbury Republican-American, this one entitled, Hunting is the Solution. The need for a bear hunt legislation bill in Connecticut never has been more urgent than it is now, but the legislature appears content with the baby step it took last year. Perhaps a human sacrifice or two would bestir lawmakers to act. Connecticut's bear population has a high reproduction rate compared to some other areas of Black Bear Range, the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection reported in February. This is in part because of the abundance of suitable habitat and excessive human-related food across their range. The population has a high potential for growth. It is estimated that there are at least 1,200 black bears in Connecticut, concentrated in the state's northwestern quadrant. A year and a half ago, Connecticut almost checked the human sacrifice box. A bear attacked a 10-year-old boy in Morris and proceeded to drag him away. His life was saved by a heroic intervention by his grandfather and a neighbor. The incident may have moved lawmakers to pass substitute Senate Bill No. 1148, Public Act No. 23-77. According to the DEEP, the act allows individuals to request permits to take bears when bears are damaging agricultural crops, livestock, or apiaries, and non-lethal responses are unreasonable or ineffective, bans the intentional feeding of potentially dangerous animals, including bears, and establishes the right to use deadly force to defend oneself, other people, and one's pets if attacked in certain circumstances. This measure is better than nothing, but not much better, especially in a state where 12,000 human-bear interactions take place every year. In most cases, bears are attracted to human habitations by the presence of trash or bird feeders. Black bears are not as aggressive as their larger cousins in the West and Alaska, but they're big, powerful predators that can be dangerous when provoked. Moreover, black bear populations have been rising. Female bears have reproduced litters with as many as 5 cubs, and the closest thing a black bear has to natural enemies are speeding motor vehicles and the occasional farmer who has laid his fill of damage to who has had his fill of damage to crops and loss of livestock. From time to time, the DEEP will send out hunters to kill problem bears. The DEEP also urges residents to buy bear-resistant trash containers and avoid putting out bird feeders, especially during the spring when bears are most active. The latter solution is potentially bad for the environment since birds, unlike bears, are experiencing population declines. The Audubon Society estimates there are 3 billion fewer birds in North America than there were a half century ago. What's needed is a hunting season with licenses issued by lottery. The objective would not be to eradicate bears, but be to control their populations and instill fear of humans in them so they avoid homes and farms. It's working in Massachusetts, the Bay State, which has a limited bear hunt, has significantly fewer car-bear collisions and annual human-bear conflicts than Connecticut, despite being home to 4,500 bears. If Massachusetts, which closely resembles Connecticut politically, can solve this problem, why do legislators wait for an inevitable tragedy instead of nipping this danger in the bud now? Time now for a visit with our regular contributor, Chris Powell. This column from his ChrisPowellColumn.com website dated April 20th, entitled "More Absentee Ballots Mean More Corruptions in Elections." Judging by voter participation in Connecticut's most recent municipal elections, Hartford may be the most demoralized place in the state. The Hearst, Connecticut newspapers reported that only 14% of Hartford residents who are registered to vote did so in last year's municipal election, when the city had the lowest voter participation among all Connecticut municipalities. The city's voter participation rate is actually far worse than reported since, as with all other municipalities, many eligible residents don't even register to vote. What is the city council's idea for curing this civic demoralization? It's to diminish election security by mailing absentee ballot applications for future elections to all residents on the voter rolls. Of course, absentee ballots have been at the center of the recent election corruption scandals in Bridgeport, where absentee ballot applications have been pressed on people who did not apply for them, and completed absentee ballots have been stuffed by political operatives into unsecured ballot deposit boxes. Absentee ballots are a necessity of democracy, but for election security, their use should be minimized, not increased. For the more a voter is separated from the in-person casting of his vote, the more potential there will be for corruption. Requests for absentee ballots should be scrutinized for validation as much as the casting of completed ballots in person should be. The Republican minority in the General Assembly is serious about this issue. The Democratic majority is not. The Republicans propose to outlaw the mailing of unsolicited absentee ballot applications to require people voting by absentee ballot to include a copy of an identification document bearing a photo, to require municipalities to provide voters with photo identification without charge, the cost to be reimbursed by state government, to require municipalities to update and audit their voter rolls regularly, and to suspend use of absentee ballot deposit boxes since the U.S. mail can do the job more securely. Democrats in Connecticut oppose requiring voters to present photo identification. The Democrats also support nullification of federal immigration law. This may not be a coincidence. On another topic, he writes, pleading poverty. Should poor people have to obey the law in Connecticut? Legislation approved by the General Assembly's Judiciary Committee suggests that poverty should confer an exemption from the law. The legislation, sponsored by four Democratic state representatives, would forbid the suspension of driver's licenses for people who have failed to appear in court as ordered or who have failed to pay fines. Suspension of the driver's license of people who ignore court orders and judgments has been an incentive for obeying the law. The rationale of the legislation is that poor people are less able to take time off from work to attend court and less able to pay fines, and of course they are. But if poverty is to excuse people from respecting the law and the courts, why should they obey any law at all? Connecticut's courts already carry hundreds of cases of failure to appear. If the Judiciary Committee's legislation is enacted, the state is sure to experience much more contempt for law and an ever-growing inventory of failure to appears, and somehow the Democrats will call it justice. And finally, on a third topic, he writes, Dillon improved Bradley. In recent years, Connecticut has put many millions of dollars into Bradley International Airport. Though the correlation between spending and improvement in state government is usually weak, the airport has improved much since the Connecticut Airport Authority was created to operate it and the other state-owned airports in 2013. For the 11 years since then, Kevin A. Dillon has been the authority's executive director, overseeing a great expansion of service at Bradley, more international and nonstop flights, more airplanes, better facilities, and more passengers, though the passengers total from the year prior to the virus epidemic has not quite been surpassed yet. Bradley makes a huge contribution to Connecticut's economy, its business environment, and quality of life, for which Dillon must be credited. He plans to retire early next year, and before he leaves, the authority should name something after him. On a lighter note, we turn to the April 24th edition of the Wilton Bulletin, and the opinion piece is written by Joe Pisani, entitled, Help, I have the turbo virus. Is that a thing? After my grandson got strep throat 3 times in 1 month, followed by a nasty intestinal virus with diarrhea and vomiting, not to mention assorted ear infections, I told my daughter, don't expect us to babysit. We're seniors and we can't be near kids who are spreading germs like grass seed, even if we're related to them. Have some sympathy for us old timers. Needless to say, that didn't go over well. Then I heard more terrifying tales about mystery viruses that were overrunning classrooms and cruise ships everywhere. Doesn't it make you wish you were on a Disney cruise with Mickey and Minnie or in second grade again? These kids spend more time in the nurse's office than they do studying, reading, writing, and Pokemon. My son-in-law, who's a high school teacher, also got sick with a turbo virus he caught from a student, which bounced around the school and back again. Everyone was catching the turbo virus. Wait a minute. I don't want to be accused of spreading fake news or have the fact-checkers breathing down my neck, especially when everyone is getting the flu from breathing on one another. My wife just told me it's not called the turbovirus. It's a norovirus. Let me quote from the CDC, an organization that should know what it's talking about, although I have my doubts. Norovirus is a very contagious virus that causes vomiting and diarrhea. Anyone can get infected and sick with norovirus, which is sometimes called the stomach flu or stomach bug. Now, where was I? Yes, it was spreading among students and teachers fast. We oldsters live in such fear of contamination that I locked our doors so my kids couldn't drop off their kids and go partying and contaminate even more people. But that didn't stop them from trying. They kept pushing the front doorbell, which doesn't work, by the way, although I've never told them. How are grandparents supposed to take care of grandkids when they're always sick? I'm convinced the government better stop worrying about banning our appliances and spending our retirement dollars and start dealing with a real crisis. Get Dr. Fauci on the hotline so he can draft a plan to save a sick America. If he's not available, call Dr. Doolittle or Dr. Frankenstein or Dr. Oz or the Wizard of Oz, because we need help. After 3 cases of strep and a bunch of other illnesses of unknown origin ravaged her home, my daughter did what she does best in a crisis and went shopping. She raced over to Target, but this time, instead of buying tchotchkes from China, she invested in a germ-killing steamer. It's not like the clothes steamer I use on my suits when I go to a funeral. My steamer doesn't kill germs, it just flattens wrinkles and leaves wet marks on my pants in embarrassing places. And it's not like those steamers that overcook asparagus. These high-powered steamers are designed to eradicate vermin such as bedbugs, fleas, viruses, bacteria, and a lot of other things we can't see, but science says actually exist. My daughter started chasing down these germs with the vengeance of Clint Eastwood. She thought she was Dirty Harriet. She steamed the whole house to protect her family's throats and gastrointestinal tracts. There is so much steam, the windows began fogging up. She steamed the refrigerator, the microwave, the sink, the stove, the tables, the chairs, the toilets, the tubs, the kitchen floor, the bathroom floor, the basement floor, the dog's crate, and a package of pork dumplings from Costco. Those pesky germs didn't stand a chance. As a precaution, I urged them to wear masks, but she insisted masks don't work and cited a half dozen studies to substantiate her claim. I, on the other hand, wear a mask to bed just in case a norovirus decides to creep under the covers and launch a sneak attack on my intestines. I cited a dozen studies to support my claim that masks work. No wonder Americans don't trust the system. For every study that says one thing, there are 2 that say the exact opposite. Then my wife decided to join the crusade to exterminate germs, so she bought a steamer. As soon as it was delivered, she unpacked it and called my daughter to learn how it works. You see, in our family, we live by a firm rule. Never read directions, because directions only cause anxiety. Besides, the prints are so small you can't read them anyway. It's easier just to wing it. Eventually you'll get it right, although you might break an appliance or 2 in the process. Her deluxe steamer is capable of decimating the entire germ population in a 25-mile radius, an estimated zillion gazillion triple trillion germs, in addition to getting rid of coffee stains on the carpet. It will also vaporize dust, pollen, mold, mites, and mildew. And it's 99.9999999% effective. I'm just worried about the 0.00001% that gets away because it could be the notorious, as yet undiscovered, turbovirus. And that's all we have time for in today's edition of Cross Currents. I've been reading from the pages of the Hartford Current, the Waterbury Republican-American, ChrisPowellColumn.com, and the Wilton Bulletin. I'm Mike Eastland. So long until next time.